Welcome back, folks. We set aside time every Tuesday morning to highlight the not-for-profit community that's making a difference each and every day in our community. And quite frankly, without the not-for-profits, we would be less than. And that's about the only way that I can put it where I think it makes the most sense, because they're doing incredible work. And a lot of these organizations, we hear about them, some come, some go, but some have been around a long, long time. And today's one of those organizations. The Youth Empowerment Project celebrated 20 years last year, and their numbers continue to grow, and the impact that they make in our community continues to make a difference each and every day. You don't hit home runs every day. These organizations recognize you got to hit base hits every day. Just keep going at it, keep going at it, keep going at it. And you begin to see the changes in the lives of the underserved population in our community. You know, we've had a lot of discussion here lately about Medicaid, how that works here. When you look at the state of Louisiana, over 30% of the people in this state or on Medicaid. That gives you a pretty good indicator. When we talk about underserved, you don't have to look very far to find stats that are emblematic of saying that. Today we are joined by Jerome Jupiter, who's the Chief Operating Officer for the Youth Empowerment Project. Jerome, welcome to the show.
Good morning. Thank you, Newell. Thanks for having us.
Jerome, thank you so much for what you guys do. I know there are a whole lot of different things that y'all do, and I know that y'all focus on four service areas. So why don't we talk about that first, if you don't mind?
Sure, yes. So, we have four service areas. We talk about our work in the four kind of bucket areas of enrichment, education, mentoring, and job readiness training. So we have our YEP Educates programming, our YEP Enriches programming, our YEP Works programming, and our YEP Mentors programming. We kind of run the whole gamut for young people as young as seven. But because we also are an education provider in the adult education arena, we have students as old as 77.
And as it relates to, let's focus, if you don't mind, for a moment on kind of young kids and what services y'all are providing there as well.
Sure. So for our YEP Enriches, which is year-round programming, that is for young people ages 7 through around 17. So YEP operates now out of 5 sites. So we were founded over 20 years ago now. As a small reentry program, first of its kind, mentoring young people returning from incarceration in New Orleans and the greater metropolitan area. But that has grown. We now work in 13 parishes. We serve about 1,000 young people and families per year through our 5 sites. Our 5 sites are in New Orleans East, Central City, Mid-City, Algiers, and then also we have an office in Hanville, Louisiana, where we serve folks all up and down those parishes there, the river parishes. But our YEP Enriches programming is for the 7 to 17-year-olds. That operates out of 2 of our sites in Central City and New Orleans East. During the school year, it is an after-school program, but it's also arts and crafts. There's a lot of recreation. We partner with the 18th Ward for recreation there. And our students come in, they get a hot meal every day, they get homework help. There are affinity groups they can join depending on what they have an aptitude to do. But that's after-school programming, 5 days a week, all free programming for our young people. That transitions in the summer to summer camps. This year we ran 3 summer camps, 2 concurrent summer camps for youth ages 7 to 12 in Central City and New Orleans East in June. And this month we're transitioning to our teen camp. But that goes along, again, all free, very robust camps, high-quality programming. Those youth camps, we served 125 in June, and we'll serve another probably 30 to 40 folks for our teen camp, which is more of college and career exploration type programming.
Jerome, while I was sheriff, I helped a number of churches and other groups with after-school programs, and it impressed upon me that those types of programs may be the biggest bang for your buck. I mean, I always thought it was a great return on the investment because a lot of folks that work in jobs just don't have a lot of flexibility, right? They're trying to make ends meet. They're trying to provide for their family. A lot of time there's no one to have at home for the kids. And being able to work through that homework and get stuff organized and having access to computers and stuff in after school, it was astounding to me how much better students did in school when they had access to programs like that.
No, absolutely. There's a lot of research to back that up. Everything that you're saying is factual. And what we try to do is, make sure that, we are really trying to break down barriers to really help folks and help young people and families and, to get the support and supportive services that they really need so that they can thrive and they can do well themselves.
And when you say, 1,000 kids in a year, that's a lot of kids. I mean, I don't know if people realize how big of a program that is. It's probably one of the biggest in the city, right?
We are. We're one of the biggest. We're probably the most comprehensive youth serving organization, I would think, in the city because of the array of programming and services that we provide.
But yes, so let's talk. Go ahead.
No, I was just saying, our staff is really dedicated. We have roughly about 50 staff members who are really trying to make an impact and help these young people improve their lives and the lives of others, which is our core values.
We touched on YEP Enriches. Let's touch on some of the other of the four areas of programming.
Yeah, so our YEP Educates, which is basically our largest program, that is an adult education. It's a high school equivalency program. The thing that makes it unique is, I think, because of it's like really low barrier access. We really want to make sure that we have, young people and not so young people can easily access our services. We offer that at three of our sites. But that's our largest program. Just this last fiscal year, we served right under 500 adult learners, ages 16 to you name it. We had a record number of graduates this year who received their high school equivalency. 142 of our students graduated week before last in June. And that was a really great thing for them. Our goal is to really help people to kind of matriculate and then move on into post-secondary opportunities, advanced training, and or employment or, opportunities for advancement within their employment. So that's our largest program. And, again, everything is free. There is a cost that comes with actually taking the high school equivalency test, which is formerly the GED, now the HISET. But we raise money privately to incur all those costs, and all people can come for free, and we work with them, we meet them where they are until they have the skills that they need and the mastery of numeracy and literacy that they have to get their high school equivalency, which is really a game changer in their lives.
It may mean nothing, but I'm just kind of curious if there's something that revealed itself. Obviously, those are big numbers. You said it's one of the largest y'all ever had. Any particular reason?
Well, I think that, I think a number of reasons, right? I think that there are folks that are not successful in a traditional K-12 school for many different reasons. It doesn't mean that they were lacking the skills, but maybe they didn't get the right type of services that they actually needed. Or maybe they were young parents or they needed to go to work at a young age, or a traditional setting was just not the right, the proper educational setting for them. What we try to do is really make sure that they have all the tools that they need, and really just working with adult learners, really believing in them and encouraging them to persist to get their highest set so that they can move on. And so a lot of that is just come, just work around your schedule. We have a very flexible schedule. We don't have to wait for semesters to enter. We have open enrollment. Folks can enroll daily. And we really just try to work with folks around their schedules of, okay, we know you have to work. We know you have children. How can YEP help? Maybe you can put some of your kids into YEP Enriches programming while we provide these services to you. And then we have our what we call student advocates, who are just doing all of the other services and supportive services to make sure that, again, our students have the tools that they need so that they can focus on getting their high set. We've been doing this now since, at least the adult education piece, since around 2007. And it's just 2006, I'm sorry. And it's just grown over the years because we know that the need is huge.
Yeah, no, those are exciting numbers. I guess it's one of those programs that you just hope continues to grow, right? Because that would be an incredible trend, a very positive trend for the community in so many different ways.
And that's our plan. You know, right now it's just really about how do we stabilize, how do we make sure that we sustain the work that we're doing so that we can turn 40 and we can turn 60. And it's really just building capacity for that and making sure that we have the right people on the bus. And we're planning, we're being strategic about that. And we're able to continue to show our data and help people along the way.
Let's talk about YEP Mentors.
Yeah, so YEP Mentors is our flagship program. So that was started, when YEP was started in 2004 by three juvenile justice advocates. And basically, it's a community-based mentoring program for young people as young as 8 up until 21. And they've been referred to by some of our community partners. That could be some fee-for-service contracts that we have with the Office of Juvenile Justice that we've had now 21 years. For youth who are returning from incarceration, but that could be youth who have never been involved in juvenile justice system, who just may need a little bit of support and to help get them on the right track. But our YEP mentors, our youth advocates, are not volunteers. They are paid staff, and we've been very intentional about that. So our staff, our youth advocates, keep their phones on pretty much 24/7. A lot of times they're responding to crises that our young people or families may be going through. A lot of times it's just, hey, my mentee has a football game, or we want to go to a Pelicans game, or just a lot of just activities like that. Our youth advocates are in the schools, sometimes if necessary, sitting in like IEP meetings. Again, just making sure that our young people just have their basic needs are met, and that they can help get that back on track.
And I think YEP Works. I'm sorry.
Yes, YEP Works is our job training program, and that's for 16 to 21 year olds. And basically, it's a social emotional learning training, but also a customer service training for young people. And it's a work-based learning program focused on employment readiness skills for young people. And so we actually have two public-facing stores. We have a bike shop called Bike Works, and we have a thrift store called YEP Thrift Works. So our young people can actually learn how to do points of sale, how to do inventory, how to interact with customers. And then for those who are mechanically inclined, they can actually work on the bikes that we work on. And those who have more of a customer service kind of feel can work in our thrift store and do the windows, the dressings of the windows with mannequins, or do the inventory or the interaction with customers. Our young people do get an actual certification from the National Retail Federation Foundation in customer service toward the end of the 10-week training. And then they also have the option of doing an internship with us where they hone more skills. And again, the goal there is to, similar to Educates, is to help young people either continue on with their education, move into post-secondary opportunities or advanced training or into the workplace. We think that this is really important, too, because we know that a lot of our young people either don't have a lot of experience with work or they have never worked before. And so this gives them some kind of real-life training on, you know, how to not get fired, how to make sure you call your boss to let them know you're going to be 30 minutes late or you can't do a no-call, no-show, and then just how to engage with the public when you're actually at work. So these kind of soft skills, as we call them, are just kind of really critical that everyone needs and to know when you're kind of, you know, going to the workplace.
Yeah, no doubt. And what I love is that each one of these programs kind of dovetails into the other, right? And it's kind of a building experience. If folks want their kids to be involved, how do they go about doing that, Jerome?
Yeah, sure. So, again, all of our programming is free. We have open enrollment, and we're accepting folks at all of our locations. There are a couple of different ways. If folks are tech savvy and into computers, they could reach us at youthempowermentproject.org, or you could call our main office in Central City, which is 504-522-1316. And someone can help you. If you go online, there is a there'll be a drop down box where you can say join us or information, and you can just put your information in, and someone will follow up. Or you can simply just call, and someone will direct you to the right person.
YouthEmpowermentProject.org or 504-522-1316. And y'all have a school giveaway event coming up on July 26th at your New Orleans East site, which is at 12,000 Hayne Boulevard. Free backpacks and fun. The entire community is invited from 9 to 11 a.m., so it's a great opportunity to get some assistance with school supplies, right?
We're really excited about that. This will be our third year doing that. Yes, it is at our New Orleans East site, at the New Orleans East Opportunity Center, where we are housed there with our partners, Educators for Quality Alternatives. But, yes, it's open to the city. Last year, we gave away over 350 computers. We had some laptops. This year, it's in partnership with Ochsner Children's Hospital. We're doing it on the 26th at 12,000 Hayne. Free backpack giveaway. We'll have food and drinks. We'll have vision and hearing screenings from Ochsner Children. So we want people to come out, get some free stuff that kids need for school, but also learn more about what YEP is doing and see if, you know, we could actually help others in the community by enrolling into some of our programs.
Thank you so much for what y'all do. Congratulations on all the great work, and please keep up the great work. Obviously, our community is better for it. Jerome Jupiter, Chief Operations Officer at the Youth Empowerment Project. Have a great week.
Thanks a lot, Neil.
Thank you, sir. We'll be right back. 504-260-1870 on the Oakland Heart Jewelers talk and text line. When we return, we'll visit with Ira Melman from the Federation for American Immigration Reform, and we'll talk about the provisions in the Big Beautiful Bill for Homeland Security and what it means. We'll be right back, folks. Stay with us. Welcome back, folks. We are joined by Ira Melman, Media Director for the Federation for American Immigration Reform. We've talked a lot about the Big Beautiful Bill, about some of the implications of same relative to taxes, relative to Medicaid, but we've spent very little time talking about the additional dollars for law enforcement and others relative to immigration. And Ira joins us to talk about that. Ira, welcome to the show.
Good to be back. Thank you.
So, Ira, this bill, incredibly important to provide this funding with 1,954 miles of border with Mexico and 5,525 miles of border with Canada. It provides a necessary funding to keep that all alive, well, and in check, right?
It does. It includes about $46 billion, you mentioned, to complete construction of the wall, to hire more border agents, more electronic surveillance of the border. So it includes a lot of money for both border enforcement and for interior enforcement. You know, we forget that under the Biden administration, you had 10 million people cross that border illegally, including 2 million people who were never encountered by the Border Patrol. You know, these are people we know nothing about. We don't know where they are. We don't know why they're here, you know, especially at a time when terrorism is a major threat to the country. It also includes a lot of money to do interior enforcement, to go out and find people who shouldn't be here and remove them from the country if necessary.
What are the latest estimates as to what the illegal alien population may be here in this country?
Yeah, FAIR estimates it to be about 18.6 million people. And that's kind of a conservative estimate. You know, we only use data that we could find. But as I mentioned, you know, there's a lot we don't know about this because it's illegal. But it's, in our estimation, it's at least 18.6 million people. And that's a number that's way, way too high. It's costing the American public billions of dollars a year. More than $150 billion a year to provide services to these people and their children who are in the United States. So it's a number that needs to come down. The administration is actively sending ICE out there to find people and remove them. But they've also done something else, which is make it clear to people that you're not going to succeed if you're here illegally. You're not going to be able to get a job. You're not going to be able to get access to a lot of benefits and services. So you might as well just go home. So it's a two-pronged strategy here. You find the people that you can, and you remove them, and you discourage the other people from remaining here.
With these additional dollars, I get a lot of questions asked all the time. I talk about immigration just about every week because I think it is an issue that we need to come to grips with and deal with. The questions that's asked is like some of this funding, is any of it going to be directed towards a greater implementation of E-Verify?
Well, that was not part of the bill, but it's certainly something that needs to be taken up. The reconciliation bill, it's dealt strictly with the budget and funding for various programs. E-Verify is in place. What we need now is legislation by Congress to make it mandatory for all employers. That would be the single greatest deterrent for people to come here illegally and work here illegally if employers knew that they had to go through an electronic verification system, just like we go through a verification system every time we use our credit cards, that they would not be able to hire people who are here illegally. There'd be an electronic record of the hire, and if they were caught hiring illegal aliens, then the government had a very strong case against them and could fine them, potentially bring criminal charges against them. So this is something that needs to be addressed by Congress. There's another bill out there, H.R. 2, which, as you may recall, passed the House in 2023, but was never brought up in the Senate. Now the Republicans control the Senate. So if the House passes it again, John Thune, who is now the majority leader, is certain to bring it up. And it includes things on E-Verify and many, many other things that need to be put in place to prevent any future administration like the Biden administration from simply throwing open the borders and disregarding our laws.
Yeah, I mean, it seems to me that the impact of that would be huge. Ira, you've been around a long time. I've been around a long time. Sometimes it's easier to get the money allocated, and it's a lot harder to execute on those dollars. When it comes to the wall, kind of likelihood of success, I mean, I know there were some successes in President Trump's last term. Do we anticipate that this is going to be all wrapped up in lawfare again?
Well, no. I mean, the authorization is there. Congress approved a border wall back in 2006. The problem was it wasn't really built. During the first Trump administration, they did build additional miles. I forget exactly how many. But, you know, when the 2020 election came around and President Biden took office in 2021, he just completely scrapped the idea. He sold off the parts of the wall, the metal sheeting and other things that were needed to build it for pennies on the dollar. So unfortunately, the American taxpayers are going to have to pay for this again. But this time, you know, it's in place. President Trump has 3.5 more years in office. He can get a lot of that done in the next 3.5 years. And as I said, the legislation authorizing it has been on the books for almost 20 years.
Well, that's good to hear, because we always wonder whether or not you're going to be able to act on the dollars once they get appropriated. In this bill, I mean, one of the areas that's always been a problem in moving cases is that we constantly hear that there's not enough immigration judges. Are there dollars here to increase that number?
Yes, absolutely. That is one of the line items in the reconciliation bill. I forget exactly how many more judges they're going to hire, but there is money in there for that. And you're right. I mean, that's absolutely what is needed. You know, when people are arrested, they have to go through a process. They have to appear before an immigration judge. And one of the things that has attracted so many people here is that they know how backed up the court system is, and that time works in their favor. So, you know, under the chaos that prevailed during the Biden administration, people would come into the country illegally. They'd be given a court date years into the future. They knew that they'd be allowed to remain here. They'd be given work authorization. And, you know, either they would disappear or find some other reason to be allowed to remain in this country. So if we can expedite the removal process, that would go a long, long way towards deterring more people from trying to come. Because, as I said, time works in their favor, not in our favor.
Yeah, it's the same principles as crime, right? I mean, if people that violate know they can get away with it and the solution rate is incredibly low, there's no incentive to stay on the straight and narrow, because the likelihood of you getting caught is slim and none, and slim just walked out the door.
Yeah. Right. You know, people have been acting rationally. You know, it was our government that was acting irrationally. But look, I mean, we understand why people come to this country illegally. They're coming here for better opportunities, better jobs. And, you know, that's all understandable. It does. We can't permit it because it does undermine the interests of everybody else in the country. But as long as we were providing those incentives and sending a clear message that if you came here illegally, you'd be allowed in, you'd be given work authorization, you'd be given, you know, a court date many years in the future, they responded rationally and they came in huge numbers. And you saw, as soon as the Biden administration left office, it completely reversed. The message being sent was, don't come here illegally. And now we have record low numbers of people trying to come across the border illegally. In June, along the southern border, where we used to get 10,000 people a day coming into the country illegally, for the entire month of June, there were just 6,070 apprehensions. So it has been night and day since January.
Yeah. It's amazing. You know, how the messaging always was, we need immigration reform, and that's why none of this is working, and that's why we can't do anything or anything else. But a lot of presidents were able to act on the laws that were on the books, to include Obama, who was coined deporter-in-chief in his first 4 years in office. And then, you know, in the second 4 years, he had an epiphany, I guess, or something. I don't know what happened, and he went completely in the opposite direction. But they were able to achieve a lot with the same laws. Nothing's changed.
You had Joe Biden saying for 4 years he didn't have the presidential authority to do this, and it turns out you know, as we all knew, that he actually did. He simply didn't want to use it. In fact, he did everything in his power to undermine it. What he really wanted was Congress to pass legislation that included a mass amnesty for people who are here illegally, that included, you know, just many new streams of people coming into the United States through the legal process, all of which would have undermined the interests of the American public. So he was really just holding the our border and our national security hostage to his desire to get legislation passed that the American public was dead set against.
So, Ira, if you would, very quickly, a lot of people don't really understand how you get to this country legally. I interviewed a woman from Turkey a while back, has been waiting at that time, I think, 14 years. Last I heard, she was still not in, so she's probably up to 16 years waiting to get into the country, and actually has family here. Not immediate family, but family here. How does it actually work? I mean, we let in, about 1.3 million people a year. Are there preferences given still? And how does that play out?
Yes, there are preferences. And, you know, you point to this Turkish woman that you mentioned. You know, she's an example of, you know, what happens when we overpromise. You know, our immigration policy should allow people to bring their spouses and their minor children to the country when they come. But we cannot promise that we're going to be able to reunite entire extended families, because each time you admit somebody under that system, the line actually gets longer. So you have these huge backups, you know, can take, as you point out, 15, 20 years to get into the United States. What we need to do is limit it to the immediate nuclear family, and then take people based on what their skills are, what they offer to the country. It's a public policy. It should serve the public interest. And we ought to be judging who we let in based on objective standards. You know, is this person likely to be a net contributor to the country? If so, we're going to prioritize that person. If the person is coming with skills that don't match the needs of our country at any given time, we should, you know, unfortunately, there are, you know, 8.2 billion people on the planet. The vast majority of them would be better off here. We simply cannot let everybody who wants to come here. We have to have a system that makes sense for the country and also demonstrate to people that we intend to enforce our laws.
Yeah, no doubt. I mean, it's just and those folks that are trying to do it legally, they are completely mystified by all of this other nonsense that's going on. You know, we're creating a special class of people, and they're like, well, wait a minute. I mean, I've been sitting outside of this system waiting to get in the right way, and now I'm being punished.
Yeah. So
it doesn't make any sense.
No, it really doesn't. Yeah, the whole system doesn't make any sense. We, you know, as I said, we promise people things that we can't deliver on, and that's not their fault. That's our fault. And then you have all these people who are coming illegally. They were getting in. They were getting all kinds of benefits. And, you know, people who have been waiting in line for years and years have every right to say, hey, what's going on here? This just doesn't seem right. And it's not right. So we need to stop overpromising, and we need to start making it clear to people that if you just come here illegally, you're not going to benefit by remaining here.
Right. No doubt. Ira Melman, Media Director, Federation for American Immigration Reform. Thank you so much for your time and your insight. Always appreciate that, and have a great week.
You too. Pleasure. Thanks.
Thank you, sir. Folks, we'll be right back. Stay with us. Got a text here that says, with same laws and no wall. Well, the benefit of the wall is it's going to reduce the recurring operational expenditures to monitor the border. And hopefully you can spend more time on interior enforcement as opposed to border enforcement if you're able to minimize and eliminate that migration. You just heard Ira Melman say that there were 6,000 that came across in the month of June, as opposed to 30 to 40,000 that were, and even more, that were coming across on a monthly basis under the Biden administration. You can minimize that 6,000 with the wall, with backed up with some level of redundancy of being an impediment with technology. It's what a lot of other countries around the world actually do and utilize, and it works. And so that's really an investment in the future of being able to reduce cost for that roughly 1,700 miles that are out there on the, 1,900 miles of border with Mexico and 5,500 miles of border with Canada. Hopefully Canada doesn't end up being a challenge like the Mexican border has been, because I don't know that we could build a wall on that in that northern territory. It would be a lot more difficult to do so. So, they've had some successes, but that number could be even less, and it would give them the ability to focus on drug importation. It would give them the ability to focus on immigration sleeper cells, homeland security issues with that same workforce. There's a lot of buckets that they work in. There's a lot of authority that they have, and that's the thinking. Yes, they've had in the short term here some successes, but it gets a lot easier to maintain those successes with the utilization of technology and physical barriers, plain and simple. I mean, we've seen it everywhere. They use physical barriers everywhere around the world, and so they work, and that's all this is. We get all caught up in the rhetoric and the symbolism of this, that, or otherwise. You know, that's all this is. It's a barrier. Is it 100% proof? No. You have people breaking out of jails that have even more series and sets of barriers. So it's not perfect. It doesn't work all the time, but it is a significant impediment. You overlay technology with that, and you make it even more secure and more capable of being able to take illegals down at the border in a safer fashion for the men and women that are working Border Patrol when you allow them to have those tools in the toolbox. We'll be right back, folks. Stay with us. Folks, when we come back after the top of the hour news break, we'll visit with Jerry Bologna, president and CEO of JEDCO, about an exciting announcement relative to the creation of the Jefferson Parish Design District. And then we'll visit with Ronald Surpass, professor of practice in the Department of Criminal Justice at Loyola, about a recent New York Times article about murderers getting away with it.